Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hi, thanks for joining the Global Marketing Podcast. Today we are welcoming Andy Korhonen, who will share some interesting insights on how to sell technology and other products and services into the U.S. market. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Wendy. Very nice to be on here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on here. So you are managing partner and CEO of Take Hill Partners, and you really focus on helping companies bring new technologies to the U.S. market. You've been SVP of U.S. Operations for EID Robotics, SVP of Business Development for Steerpath, and you have 20 years of experience bringing new products to market through publicly traded companies and VC-backed startups. And you've got a BS in computer science from Oulu University. So first I have to ask, how many languages do you speak?
Well, being born in Finland, obviously I speak Finnish. I spent half my life in Finland, half in the US. And so Finnish, English, and in Finland, the second official language is Swedish. So I'll speak some Swedish and some French and some Germany. I'm some German, but I mean, I would say English and Finnish are the fluent languages.
Yeah, that's fabulous. I wish here in the United States we learned to speak more languages when we're young and your brain's ready to learn them. All right, so let's start out with some fun. What's your favorite, and I'll say foreign word, but it can come from any language?
Oh, that's interesting. I guess for the American audiences, maybe the foreign words are kind of more interesting. So I would, in Finnish language, there's which is kind of weird language. It's not related to any other languages. It's kind of interesting language because the words can be really long, and the word can change the meaning when you add endings at any word. So in terms of commerce, for example, there's a word. Saippua kauppias, which is a one word, 15 letters, and it's a person who's selling soap. And what's interesting in that word is that it's the same word when you spell it one way or the other. So if you spell it from the back to the end, to the forward, then it's the same word.
Oh, wow. So if you reverse it or you spell it forward, it's the same
word. So then it's the letters are kind of going interestingly enough, forming the same word regardless if you spell it from the beginning or from the end.
So how do you spell it?
Well, Saippua Kauppias.
Oh my gosh. And that's a person who sells soap.
Yeah.
I love it. That's a good one. I tell you, I've heard some good Finnish words.
Maybe not the really useful in everyday life, but I mean, just to let you know that.
Yes, such a long word that can be spelled. I think that's the longest one I've ever seen that you can spell backwards and forwards. So
yeah.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing now.
Well, I've been in a B2B technology business for over 20 years. I've been CEO three times in the venture-backed companies, and I've been also working in the public traded company as a technology side of things. And since 2017, I left my last CEO position, and I put together this consulting company called Take Hill. And here we have two service models. One is helping overseas companies to enter the U.S. market from different countries, mainly focusing on Europe, And secondly, also helping big corporations scouting for new technologies, finding new innovative vendors for them to adopt. But primary work is really helping European companies to enter USA. And as I'm from Finland, many of those companies are Finnish companies.
Okay, so say you have, so there could be a lot of people from outside the US listening to the process that you take through, take a company through to enter the US market, but there's also companies that are in the US that might want to go international. First off, what do you think the biggest fear of people, the biggest fear that people have when they're entering a new market?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's often, especially when you enter the USA, but maybe also when you enter some other larger market areas, the fear is that it takes much more time and money than you expect in the beginning. And you spend millions of dollars, and then at the end you fail, and then you have to come back, and you lost all the money and reputation and everything. So it's a big risk in many ways. But then my goal here has been trying to mitigate that fear by taking like a lean approach to the market entry, and that's really focusing on preparation work first, and then steps that are not requiring you to invest millions of dollars during the market entry, but first make sure that you are competitive and you have what it takes to be in business in that target market, and only then start investing in a bigger amount of money.
Okay, so why don't you walk us through the process? Say you get a company in Finland that's interested in coming to the United States. They've got that fear. How would you work them through the process?
Yeah, it's really practical, and I'm speaking as a former CEO who have been overseas, and I've been using in the past the business consultants in USA, and I've been frustrated many times and on how to make it happen myself. So I have some scar tissue on the to remember things to. That should not have happened, and maybe the ways that it should not have been done. So then based on that, we have formulated this program trying to be really practical and customer focused. And we have three steps here. One is really the simply basically market research. We call it scorecard in the sense that we try to build a picture together with client management on what are the criteria in entering the market that are important. And that is really simple, fundamental stuff like what is the competition in the target market? What's the target customer? What's the value proposition in terms of the ROI? And what's the buying behavior? And so forth and so on. And when we have created that scorecard, then we ask ourselves, so does it look like now that we are competitive in this market? And if we can say yes, then we enter the second step, which is basically trying to find those clients, partners who are paying money for your solution. And if we end up finding somebody who's paying money for your solution, then we have basically validated that our first hypothesis in the scorecard phase was right. And then we can enter the third step, which is then setting up a subsidiary and hiring people and finding an actual physical place for office and so forth. And it sounds like too simple, but I mean, sometimes you wonder when you talk to these overseas clients that there's some many of these fundamental things that they haven't thought at all. So the way we approach this is that when you enter the new market, you have to basically build the strategy from scratch again. Like if you are familiar with the startup process in today's startup world, when you start a company, you build this lean canvas, like a strategy canvas that has 9 points of a strategy that when you enter the market with your new product. So I'm telling people that when you enter the new market, you have to fill that canvas again. So what you did in the home market is not, typically it's not valid in a new market, because you have a different type of customers, different ROI, and specifically different competition in new markets. So you have to look at all those 9 strategy points again, and only then you can be educated yourself to say if I'm ready to enter the new market or not.
Okay, so let's go back to step number 1 and break it down a little bit more. Talk to me how that would play out. How long does it take? What you expect from the business owner? What you do? Give me more information about that.
Yeah, it's not really complicated, but it does require some time and effort to make it happen in a way that you have collected all information. So I would say that the typical process is maybe a minimum 2 to 3 months that we talk to customers, we talk to competition, and we try to understand where's the position for this new entrant in this new market. And it is really interesting often to observe that many of the companies entering the new market, especially with the younger companies, they are really confident about their solution and their current position in the market. But then at the same time, they didn't spend too much time in analyzing the competition in a new market. Like in USA, you have a hyper-competitive environment here. And often when you have a solution in Europe, even though you think that it's the only solution that's available, then when you come to USA, you have easily 5 to 10 exactly similar looking competitors here. So then just by starting with 15-minute Google search, you could do much of this work already. But it's kind of mind-boggling why people don't do that. So then that's one of the most important things is to understand the competition. But just in general, on a higher level, in the first step, it really depends on what kind of business you are in and what's the stage and what kind of market. And I would say that on the highest level, you could split the market in two. You can enter when you are operating in a market that is a new market where you have developed something like many startups do. They have developed something new that they claim that they are filling an unmet need, and they have created a new solution. Then when they enter the USA, then we have to really first prove that the value proposition that they have found out to be in Europe, for example, it still makes sense in the USA, because we may have a different customer behavior, different use cases, different regulation, ROI, whatever, that whatever value you saw in Europe, then we don't know yet if it's a good fit in the US market. So you have to first clarify the value proposition in this new market situation. And then the other side, if you are then entering a market that is existing market, where the value prop is really well understood, ROI is understood, then the question is how much better you are than the competition, and how are you better? What's the differentiation? So the differentiation question is the number one problem with the market entry programs, that people didn't do the homework and they tried to enter the market, and only at the end they understand, well, we didn't have a competitive product. So then in the existing market situation, to understanding the competing vendors and specifically understanding what's the differentiation versus a good enough criteria in the market. And I'm talking about the B2B enterprise business here. I'm not really a consumer guy. So when you talk to B2B people and when you're selling to enterprise market, there's always a criteria that tells you what is a good enough solution for that solving any particular problem. And when you enter the market, that's the important criteria to consider, because sometimes, especially European companies, they enter the market and they claim that they have a really high performance, really reliable solution, But sometimes if it's faster or more accurate or whatever, it doesn't really matter if the market does not require the higher performance or hi-fi solution.
Oh, interesting.
So the important is really to understand if you can be competitive versus the good enough. And if you claim that you have a 10x better product, then you must be able to explain why is it important to be 10x better. And the differentiation and all the nuances of that is really important, and you have to look at it in many, many angles. And I would say that's the number one importance in this first step. And then that's often the most typical market entry situation, because there are not too many of those companies who enter a new market where there's no competition. That's a really unusual situation. So most of the time, we are in an environment where we need to really carefully look at who we are competing against.
Can you give us a couple examples where you have a company that, you know, probably pretty similar, their differentiation, where one was strong enough to be successful and one wasn't? Or can you pick those out really quick?
Well, I should have been doing a better job in preparing some stories here. My problem is that many of the clients that I have are under NDAs, so then I cannot really mention names here. Too many, especially in those, I would like to talk about the failures, but then that's not really easy to talk about with using the client names.
Well, you can use company A and company B. I recognize the confidentiality of that. And maybe it's more a story about how to look at it. Like if you come in and you do the research and you look at what's out there, are you pretty good at picking up pretty quickly that they don't have enough differentiation and it's not going to work? Or is there always something you could turn it into that's going to be stronger?
Well, there's in general, there's, for example, in today's world, where the space where I'm been spending most of my time is IoT, sensor technologies, and cloud analytics. And that's a technology platform. It's really, really difficult to differentiate, because often there are so many ways to measure things with sensors that is good enough measurement. And then you can put that in the cloud, and then it's cloud. You can do analytics and software, and that's not, you know, it's difficult to do that really differentiated way. So I would say that those companies who are trying to enter the market that have a platform approach, meaning saying that, oh, we have built this solution and it's got all these sensors and all these data points, and then we have this cloud and look at how wonderful platform dashboards and analytics we have, and they are really proud of it because they have done lots of good engineering work and they must have a core competence on that area. But then the question is, well, I mean, everybody's doing that already, so
right.
So the question is, when you enter the market and you come from Europe, then the challenge you have is that if somebody in the US, if somebody in New York or in Boston have a similar solution, then you already in the get-go, you are in a not so good position because you are overseas. So that being on overseas is considered as a risk factor. Even sometimes European companies like you come from Sweden or Finland or Switzerland, you think that, well, because we are from Sweden, we have a high quality product. But then in USA, the conservative buyer is looking at it and saying, well, that's a risk for me because it's so far away. So that's a challenge. And then I would say that on the other side, if you have that platform of solution and you enter a new market, if you have really focused that in a specific industry in a laser focused way, you understand some specific niche of a manufacturing industry, in some particular manufacturing, let's say like one client I have is focusing on LED lighting industry, and they have innovations with that. So even though the innovation or technology per se is not so so unique, but because you have laser focused solution for one industry problem, that creates the advantage if you don't have a similar focused companies in the target market. So you can look at it in many ways, but I would say that the more difficult approach you will have, the less focused you are. So I would always say that if you're laser focused on solving one particular problem, I mean, if you're doing really, really well, and if you can somehow differentiate yourself at least a little bit, then you have a good chance to be successful.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to dig into, is everybody knows they need to differentiate, yet it can be very difficult. So there you said, focusing on a specific niche manufacturing target industry. So that would be one way. So it's not really by the technology, but it's by the industry. What other ways have you seen companies differentiate?
Well, differentiation and by being laser focused, of course, it's the number one. But that itself is not differentiation if others are doing exactly the same thing. So then you must be able to tell, okay, in this niche sector, why we are better. And again, if you can say that you're 10x better, then that stops the discussion. Then they can just start selling, because people, that 10x is good. Often that is not 10x, it's maybe 1.2x. And then you have to be really, really sure that you can be, you can find differentiation in more than one aspect of things. But yeah, I would say that differentiating yourself in a technology is, of course, one. If you can have a meaningful advantage by being faster or more accurate, whatever technology can provide, and if that's important, then that's of course good. Knowing the problem you're solving, that's my favorite. That if you are really experienced in that industry, understanding what the customer problem is, and then you solve that exact problem better than others, then that's my best way that I like, because then that resonates with your target buyers really well, your expertise. Last one, of course, is that if everything's being same, of course you can differentiate with price, but then that must be supporting your own business model. And if you have some, you know, operational innovation inside that you will be able to sell products much cheaper than others, of course that's really compelling. If you can say we are, you know, 2x cheaper, then that's of course great, but that often is not the case. So
right. Or the other thing that I've seen is if you can't go cheaper, which is not a good position to come in at, is also how you package and price.
Yeah, and how the pricing model, of course, and the business model in general, and then at the end, you know, they're in the technology engineering circles, the comparing the features and performances is the traditional method, but then more and more in today's world, it's about the story and how can you tell the story and how do you look on the website, for example, and that's by the way, one of those things that we have to do quite often, that people come to trying to enter the US market, and when you look at the website, it just looks awful. And I mean, compared to the other competing vendors, there's no like a general standard. You have to always ask, does it look good or bad compared to the other vendors? And then often it's not at the bar of the competitors here in the USA. And then you have to start by changing the way the company looks and the chasing the way they're telling the story, so that it really resonates with the target market. So then sometimes, so you can be a, you know, same similar technology, similar performance and similar pricing, but if you look, you know, more attractive as a company, the way you do, what kind of values you have and what kind of people you have, then people buy from people. So then if you have a good story, then of course that's one way to differentiate as well.
So I remember talking to you before, and you were telling me the differences of selling in Finland versus the United States and how much more important the story is in the United States. So tell a little bit more there, like if you were going to be developing a website in Finland versus the United States, what would a good website look like? Because I have a feeling they'd be very, very different.
inserting some joke into that, but I would say that traditionally that was true, especially like 20-30 years ago, when you compare the different markets. And I would say Northern Europe and Europe in general, and Northern Europe is specifically, it's more engineering driven. Maybe it's come from the cold climate or whatever. I can't tell any other difference that would make that happen. But
people stay inside and figure out.
Yeah, it's dark and cold, so then they become more serious and more factual. I would say European and Northern European approach specifically is more fact-based and less marketing spin and less promising stuff that they can potentially cannot do. While USA is hyper-competitive, it's this large market and so many players that you are forced to be really hyper-competitive and maybe a little bit over-promising stuff and putting marketing spin. Like the example I've been using is Steve Jobs when he launched a MacBook Air some, I don't know, 10 years ago, whatever. And he launched that as a world's thinnest laptop. And he took the market with that, and the media was going crazy after that. And nobody noticed that the next day, Samsung came in and said, well, we actually have a thinner laptop, but nobody cared because Steve Jobs said, well, to his best knowledge, that's the best, that's the thinnest. But then that's the kind of marketing boldness that you seldom can expect from Northern European countries, to be really bold claiming something while you know that you can be wrong, but then at the moment you believe in that statement. So the whole marketing is at this different level in USA, and because we are maybe more fiercely competitive here. And then that's fine tuning in terms of promising stuff and being bold on what you believe in. It's at a different level in the USA compared to the Scandinavia. When you're talking about the building a website and the stories, then that's often the really the fundamental there, that especially in the early days in Finland or Sweden, you saw websites that, and still today, where people are talking about the product and lots about the technical details and performance. But then in USA, it's more about the customer, the benefit. Why do you need this? What's the value in this for you? And then bridging that. When you bring companies to the USA, you have to just make sure that the focus is in the right spot when they talk about the service or the product.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about language with the companies coming into the US. So, you know, there's definitely some cultural changes that go on there. What are the companies doing for translation to make sure that English readers can take in the information?
Well, I have to say that now, last maybe 10, 20 years time, with new millennials generation specifically, you know, even the faraway startups in Europe or wherever you go on this globe are becoming more and more global. So they understand that if they like to be successful building the next unicorn, that needs to be a global approach. And they understand that many of the competitors, especially in the ICT sector and technology, are in the USA. And they have to be using the same language and same international way of communicating. And it's more and more clear today that in the B2B technology world, the U.S. American English is becoming the de facto way to communicate. So maybe unlike 10 or 20 years ago, people are becoming really much better in using the same language. So that translation issue is, in terms of the language itself, is kind of a becoming a not so big problem anymore. I would say that the translation is really about the nuances and how you communicate things, because your market is different, your customers are different. And let's say in Northern Europe, like let's say you're in Finland, which is a small country, the customers are smaller and their needs are different. And when you come to the USA, you have lots of Fortune 500 clients here, and the size of the client is so different, so much bigger, and also the way to communicate must be different. So then it's not specifically about the language itself, but the way you communicate things.
Yeah, do you think machine translation will ever get to the point where it'd be able to take that into account?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
By the way, that's a maybe interesting point. I spoke with somebody a few months back, and in terms of the differences, one is that maybe again, especially in Northern Europe, maybe again because it's so dark and cold, people are more blunt in their communication than in USA, and to the extreme that like in Finnish language, it's the whole concept of small talk, it's not really in the Finnish DNA, that they are not changing, you know, they're not chit-chatting so much, because especially in the past, in history, and that then, for example, the word no, you hear more often in negotiation, the Finnish engineers can easily say no, and that's it. While in the US and American engineers, he would use all kinds of a rosy language to explain the same thing in many words that, well, but he would not use the word no. He would just explain why it's not possible. But then it's more, and it's not about being unfriendly but it's just the way of communicating. It's more factual, more to the point, and you're not using like a small talk expressions to going around the topic. So.
Right. Yeah.
But also that then it means that what's in the positive side, to be more factual, more on the topic, to the point in Scandinavian culture, means that also that you really, really highly value the true facts of things. And the respect comes true, being trustworthy. If you say something, then must really hold true. And then maybe that's the one reason why Scandinavians are not really big on making bold claims that may not be easy to keep in the future. So then if you like in American, I remember when I came to the USA, people talk about, okay, hey, let's go out for dinner at some point. And then if Finn says that, then you really expect that to become true, that you go to dinner. But then I didn't understand that that's part of the small talk, that you just say things like that and then you may not mean them. So then it's the other one is when I was a young kid, that was the first time in the USA, and then that was really early. I was kind of learning English, but then the question people ask about, so how are you? So then you really think about that, they're asking to they like to hear how you are, but I mean that was not the case. But then again, that's not part of the like a Finnish language to really ask the question without expecting the accurate answer.
Right. So just with language alone on those questions, it's a big shock. So what other surprises did you have when you came to the U.S. and started getting involved in American business?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is really that the market size is so large and the customers are so big that there's lots of red tape and lots of paperwork here, lots of forms, I would say, maybe more than in many European countries. And when you deal with bigger clients, the sales cycles also are much longer. So, for example, we have one client we have been working with, the GE here, and it after the first meeting, we spent 14 months to get to the point where we start talking about the PO. Sometimes these big clients and big processes and big corporate operations, they just they're slow to move. So maybe the slowness and complexity of regulation sometimes has been a kind of surprise in the beginning.
So it's real interesting because you have a lot of companies that want to come into the United States. But if you think about what you've talked about, hyper-competitiveness and more red tape and a long sales cycle, why is it that companies want to come into the U.S.?
Well, I mean, if you are, and let's talk about the venture-backed companies who are relatively early stage, let's say under $10 million. Those companies are funded by venture investors, and they only thing that the venture investors care, VC investors care about is the growth. And if you are operating a small market like in Sweden, at some point you will need to, you know, grow beyond your home country if you really like to grow the way that the investor expect. And then you ask yourself, where should I go? And because you're operating in a B2B technology market, then the place to go is the USA, because maybe almost half of the B2B technology potential is the USA. Well, let's say at least more than one third of the ICT purchase happening in global and USA. And then when you come to USA compared to Europe, we are a larger economy than Europe, and we are homogeneous. So then if you try to, and I've done this myself, I mean, try to expand business in Europe from Sweden to Germany to France, the UK, and every country has a different flavor of language barriers and their own regulations, while even though sometimes in USA can be lots of red tape and forms, but still it's a homogeneous market that if you have a solution that is better than others and has a great value proposition, then it scales really fast here in USA. And then in addition to that, if you are a venture-backed company, most likely your end goal is to get the company be acquired at the end so that you can return money to investors. And then you can ask, so who's going to be buying your company? So most likely, if you're really successful, it's going to be a U.S. Corporation who's acquiring your company. And if you're not in the U.S. market, then it's less likely that you can maximize that opportunity at the exit of the company. So being in the USA, in the marketplace where you can scale and where your company can be acquired with the maximum value, makes sense.
So if I turn that around and say, okay, that's why companies want to come into the US, why would US companies ever want to go international?
You mean the American companies or in general?
Yeah, American companies going international. What's the advantage to them?
Well, I would say it's still about the growth. It's a maximizing, well, the old saying, maximizing shareholder, you know, value in terms of the company size and profits. If you're maxed out in your home market, being in the USA, if you can find growth in other areas with the bigger return that you have to pay, invest, and then of course, in maximizing shareholder value, it makes sense. Just this nature of capitalism that you have to always be growing, right?
Always be growing. ABG, huh? Always
be growing. Grow forever, right?
Uh-huh. And what advice would you give to U.S. companies going into other markets?
Well, it's interesting that especially with the times we live today, there's the people, the way they're required USA and the world may be a little bit different than it was maybe a few years or 10 years ago. I would say that sometimes Americans go to Europe and they say they try to they're not really willing to be Americans in a way that they would be bold and they would really show that they believe themselves. They like to say that, oh, in USA we don't have a so long history and we don't have this and that. So then sometimes somehow they are kind of overcompensating what they believe that the Europeans think about themselves. But I would say that in today's world still America is leading in many ways the technology world specifically, and the Americans going overseas, they still can be really confident that they are literally holding a leading position here in many ways, and innovation is particularly. So when you go to like a Scandinavia or Finland or UK, whatever, don't try to overcompensate what the media is talking about today in terms of America's position, maybe sliding down. I don't think that's not the true at all in the technology world. But at the same time, when you do that, there is in Europe and in Northern Europe, the way of communicating is more factual. So then overly used marketing spin is not always considered the best approach. So then in Europe and Northern Europe, you would always like to back up your claims with actual facts and lots of facts, and even better with science. So then prepare for finding concrete factual statements for any claims you make.
So it's really complex with Americans going international. They're trying to overcompensate for what they think they might not be as good coming from the US, like other countries are getting stronger. Yet, you're saying that the US still leads in technology. Did I get that right?
Yeah, maybe I will. I'm just kind of thinking while I'm speaking here. I maybe could be able to formulate my thought better after spending a few minutes more time about preparing my statement. But I would say in general, my number one advice would be to just be more factual when you go to Europe. Just use less bold marketing spin, because that's the way the business are communicating in Europe. But at the same time, then don't go to extreme trying to overcompensate what you might think if you read that the media today, that that USA would not be leading position in the future, because I don't see that there's any reason to doubt that the USA will be leading the technology world for long term to the future.
Okay, so what, if I paraphrase it, is that US companies are still leading in technology, there's interest in those products, yet the same thing that you were saying about companies coming into the US is that you need to adapt your marketing communications for language and culture to make sure you're successful.
Yeah, both ways. I mean, when you come to USA, you need to adjust your language to be a little more bold, more marketing and more customer driven. And when you go from USA to Europe, you must adjust your language to be a little bit more factual, more specific in terms of what's actually functional and what's not. So then, depending which way you go, you have to just adjust your language and the claims accordingly.
And so when you bring a company, when you're working with a company to bring them into the United States, and they need to change their marketing message and probably change it from Finnish to English, how do you go about doing that?
Well, often most of the companies who really have any dreams about big business, they build their websites already in the local language and English language. So that's given. Often, though, in like in Northern Europe, the UK English is the first choice. And then sometimes in some particular sectors, specifically in USA, the UK English is not really the best. And I would say that in B2B world globally, the American English is the way to go. So often we have to just adjust the expressions so that they are more aligned with the competing vendors here in USA, and try to make you look like more that you're familiar with the US market. And by the way, one part of the process that often that when you come to USA, then we would recommend in the beginning to have a virtual address and virtual telephone number here. And then at least then when I'm an enterprise buyer, I can look at the, because first thing I hear about you, I'm looking at your website and asking who are these guys. And then if I see a address in Boston or New York, it's much more comfortable if you have an address in Oulu in Finland, because you have never heard about that. You have never heard that place. So then, in changing the website or language, and adding the local contacts in USA, it's really important. And by the way, even though I'm now maybe selling my services here, but I'm speaking also as a former CEO using services, consulting services. But then, when you come to USA, for example, example market, you can, when you have proven that there's a market for you here to enter, and you have competitive, so then you can either try to do it overseas, and that's always problematic, because when you start growing, then you know that's a risk factor for any buyer that there's nobody here in USA. Or then you can hire your like a biz dev director, and then that will cost you like a 200,000 plus a year, and that can be expensive in the beginning. You're not really sure that it's going to be continuing longer term. So the really practical solution is to use some type of consulting service where you have much more flexibility in hiring and firing people, and the costs are not always full time. So for all flexibility, you would like to consider using some kind of in the beginning, some kind of maybe part-time consulting resource to really prove the market. And that came from the you asked about the website language. So my point was that having the language that matches the local competition here, and having the also local contact information is important. And when you have local contact information, then you may have different options how to do it. And I'll always start with the consulting service in the beginning.
Okay. And so you offer those services through Take Hill Partners, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So you could get a part-time person rather than hiring a full-time biz dev that could take it to finding the clients.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's say you could like we spoke about these steps. The first was just the scorecard, when you look at the market and do the market research and build your competitive position. There you could maybe use, a couple of days a week person for 1 month or 2 months. And then when you go to the next step, when you actually get in the business development, then I guess the same amount of money, same amount of time may be okay in the beginning, 1 or 2 days a week. And then when you start after that, the third step, when you actually set up a subsidiary and start hiring people, of course, then you can start talking about your full-time people and a team. But in those first two steps, I would always use the as flexible as possible approach, and then having a part-time consultant there would be the most affordable and most flexible way to do it.
Okay, so that would be very much like a manufacturer would hire a distributor to sell.
Except that when you enter the market, and you talk to the prospective buyers and companies, then you like to use the company brand. So you would like to have a consultant who takes your website address, your email address, and acts as your team member, because then he can speak for you. He can say that he's part of this company team. And then if you're a buyer, then it looks like that you actually have entered the USA, because somebody's there with local address and telephone number, and he's got a title in your company. So then it looks like that you are already established this in the USA. And which is true at that moment, even though it's not really a full-time person. So.
Right. Okay. So take help partners. Somebody could certainly hire you to come in as a part-time person, and you specialize in technology. What if somebody's coming in from another industry? How would they go about finding a consultant like that, either here in the U.S. or someplace else? Because that's a good way to go about doing that.
Well, first of all, when you talk about enterprise business or B2B technology industries or B2B business in general, then I would say that the fundamentals are mostly the same. So in terms of the business strategy, there's not the big difference. But then, of course, where the difference comes is the customer and industry, if they have some nuances that are really different, like, for example, pharmaceutical industry or healthcare industry or manufacturing industry, they have all a bit different takes. And then you would like to find people who are experts in those industries, who understand how the customer behave, how the customer think, and what's important, what's not. So in USA, I would say there's no difficulty finding consultants helping you who understand those industries, because that's the starting point. And then what comes to the fundamentals in market entry, there are not too many market entry consultants in USA, but I mean, and that's, I guess, why I put this company together, that we are focusing on building strategy for any market entry. And then if there's some specific industry, then we will find a person who has that expertise. So I don't know how to, I cannot list a competitors for myself or for Daykill that I could point to that would do the exactly same thing. So I would just always recommend people to, if they hire a consultant, hire somebody who understands your customers. That's the starting point.
Okay. Yeah, because that can, I mean, it's a great idea to do that. And anybody who is particularly coming from Northern Europe in technology, you're the go-to person for that. Yet if you're coming from a different area or different industry, that can be somebody difficult to hire. But if you think about it, like you said, is hire someone who understands your industry, your customer.
Yeah, but of course, if you when we talk about overseas companies coming to USA, there's a value in understanding both cultures and both languages, because then, right. Otherwise it's difficult to translate the business value. And therefore, if you come from Italy, for example, then you might be better off hiring somebody who understand Italian business culture and US business culture. So somebody who's been living in Italy and in USA, because then he will go through the language barriers and also understand a different take on business in both countries. And therefore, of course, myself having been born in Finland, I would claim I'm the best for that market. But then I may not be the best for Greece, for example, or some other markets that I'm not familiar with. So.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. That's very good advice, that if you want to enter a new market, you start with a consultant that would be from your home country, is living in that country, is local, understands both cultures, and understands your customer.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's a good formula to think about. Yeah, okay. Let's talk about you for a little bit. I'm kind of curious. We're going to switch it more to a personal level to get to know you. What's been your favorite vacation?
Favorite vacation? That is an interesting question. There are vacations before you have the family and kids, and then there are vacations after you have family and kids. let me start with that.
That is so true.
I'm not saying one is better than other. They're just different.
Just different. Yeah.
For example, when I was a single guy, I went to diving in Maldives. Ooh. And then spending a couple of weeks in a small island in the Indian Ocean, diving with a group of young people. That was a kind of fabulous vacation that all of us remember, and something, you know, exciting and totally new. But when you have family, and I have three daughters, and they are now older, but when they were kids, then the vacation has a different meaning. And then you like to find a place where everybody can enjoy together. But trying to find a little bit similar spot, if I need to pick something, was in Florida. We have this, next to Naples, we have this island, Sanibel Island. I don't know, you know Sanibel Islands?
Oh, yes, Sanibel Island. My mom owns the place.
Yeah, Sanibel Island is one of those places where there's nothing else to do than but just be at the beach and collect seashells.
Oh, it's supposed to be one of the best places in the world for collecting seashells.
Yeah. So, yeah. But my point being that there's no distraction for just relaxing. There's no industry around you. So.
Yes. Yes. And yes. So you get full attention from your girls when you're there.
Yeah. So there you have I had one island when I was, you know, bachelor, and then an island when I was family man.
Ah, so you like islands. I hear that. All right. How about your most rewarding cross-cultural experience in work? You've lived in some different places, and you've dealt with a lot of different cultures. So what's been one of the most memorable, rewarding, different, shocking?
Well, I've spent time in different places. I've lived 1.5 years in Lebanon, in Middle East. I was part of the UN mission, UN forces there, and I've done business in many countries in Asia, and I've also did some project in Africa, and I spent 15 years in USA. So there are quite a many memorable moments here and there. I don't know exactly what to pinpoint, but then I would say that sometimes when you go to places and when you go to a place and find it interesting, if you were in vacation, sometimes quite often what's exotic and exciting and interesting when you're vacation, it's just the problem when you're trying to do business.
Yes.
And like you know, visiting Japan or Tokyo, where it's a great place to do business, but then when you walk around the street and when you don't know how to read the street signs, of course this becomes a problem for you. Or when we were setting up a weather stations in the Botswana in Africa, in the wildlife reserve, that was really exciting. Would have been an exciting vacation, but when you need to meet the deadlines there for business, then it's just a huge problem. But then, but I don't know. It's more and more you do business with different cultures, more and more you begin to understand that people are basically the same wherever you go. There's no difference. Everybody have a similar problems, and they have families and kids and husbands and wives and, you know, there's I guess that's the maybe the after the 20 years of international business that you come to realize that there are not too many differences. So
yeah, that's very insightful, because I mean you've done business in every continent, right, except for Antarctica. Is that right?
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Antarctica, my company, Vaisala, where I was then, they had a weather station, weather-related sensor business in Antarctica. So then I was part of that company. So then, yeah, I've been there as well. I have not physically been there, but selling products of them.
So you have done business in every continent?
In that sense, yes. I have not been every continent, but done business in every continent. Yes, yes.
Wow, I think that's the first person that I met that could make that claim. And that is fascinating. What you come out of that is people are the same. They're dealing with the same problems. Well, yeah. I don't think we can top that. I think we're going to end on that note. So I want to say thank you very, very much for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you, Wendy. It was really, really enjoyed this. And the work you do is really important. So I'm looking forward to hearing this podcast later.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And if people want to find you to learn more about you or Take Hill Partners, where's the best place to go?
Yeah, they can just go to takehill.com.
T-A-K-E-H-I-L-L.com. T-A-K-E-H-I-L-L.com. And that's the best place to find you.
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. If you learned something today or you had a laugh or an insight, tell somebody about this podcast. You can find it all on your favorite places to listen. And we'll talk to you next time.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.